This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today, I'm joined by Kite Kim, an experiential design entrepreneur whose global work has pushed the boundaries of how we interact with space and story. From public art at SF MoMA and the Whitney to interactive installations at Art Basel, Kite's career has spanned the cutting edge of design. Now, as co-founder of Foviate, he's building a platform that helps architects present their creative visions more clearly, connect with clients more effectively, and close more deals profitably. Kite Kim, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hey, Mark. Yeah, thank you so much for having me here. It's an honor and a pleasure.
I'm looking forward to this. I'm happy you're here. I always love talking to founders. I find it interesting to hear where the ideas for your businesses come from and the process that it takes to get it from that initial idea all the way through to the point where you can have it as a product and talking with investors and building it, building your team, building the product, expanding globally. So I want to have that conversation about that process. But before we do that, I want to know your story, your origin story. When did you discover your passion for what you do, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah, I mean, to go really far back, I've always been interested in art as a kid. And I was constantly drawing, sculpting, stuff like that. And I didn't really know architecture was a profession until I got into high school. And my aunt was an architect, and she kind of like, you know, held my hand. I was like, oh, there are people who do this kind of work. And I always thought, you know, it was an engineer or something like that. I never really thought about architecture.
Were you drawn to buildings or focused mostly on art?
Focused mostly on design, actually, I would say, looking back on it, and with like an aesthetic. I really liked more aesthetic, you know, products, films, objects, buildings, stuff like that. I just didn't really have the knowledge or the words to describe, you know, what I was into. So it was really just kind of a random summer program at the Boston Architectural College that one of my friends, William Barnard, basically convinced me to go to with him. And then that's where I was like, oh, this is like a whole area of study. that you can do. But I wasn't sure that traditional architecture was for me. So I actually went to art school first at University of Michigan, and then halfway through my program switched to architecture, as I'm sure is common with many folks. Yeah, my career has always kind of straddled the lines between the two, art, architecture. That's how I became an experiential designer eventually.
And you graduated from Michigan?
That's right, yeah. So I got a major in architecture and a minor in art.
Got it. So what did you do after school?
So after school, actually, there was an artist who was speaking at a lecture series in the art school. His name is Rafael Lozano Hemmer. He's a Mexican-Canadian media artist, makes massive public art installations. And after I graduated, I was applying to a whole bunch of corporate firms, and my heart wasn't in it. So they were horrible applications. And then I remembered this crazy artist, and I was like, I should just message that guy and see what's up. So I found the person who organized the lecture series, got her email, told her I wanted to, you know, talk to one of the artists. And then she connected me with someone from his team, who unfortunately was no longer there. So then I got rerouted to another person. And then eventually we ended up having a call, and I had just given him like a cold email about Brexit and how I thought, you know, the creative world was changing inevitably by this decision, because I knew he's a very sociopolitically minded artist. And he didn't respond for 2 weeks. And I was like, oh, shit, okay. But he was like, yeah, sorry, I was on vacation, but we should, you know, have a call. Like, this was a super weird email. So
did you follow up with him, or did he just after 2 weeks found the email and responded?
I can't remember, but I think he found the email and responded, if I remember correctly. And then we just had a random Skype call. That's how old this was, right? This was Skype.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he was like, this sounds great. Like, can you move here in a week? I was like, no, I can't move countries in a week. So we compromised at 10 days. But yeah, basically pitched myself as an architect that he needed, as someone who, an artist who creates big installations. And I knew that from the work that he produced, he must have a team of some size. And it ended up being about 8 people. So then I joined that team, and we'd eventually grow to be about 20 people after my 6 years there.
What was your role there? What did you do?
Like I had proposed, I became the lead architect there because there was an architect.
Nice. That's a lesson all by itself, is that you just,
yeah,
you
pitch
created
yourself, everybody.
You created a position, right? And then pitched that position to somebody who might need it.
Mm-hmm. I think I was really strategic in the sense that I really wanted to work for someone who I knew could use the skills of an architect, but wasn't an architect themselves. So I was like, how do I differentiate myself from, you know, Michigan's a huge school. So I was like, I'm always thinking, how do I differentiate myself to the other 40,000 students here, right?
Right.
Let's go into somewhere where being an architect with an arts background is very coveted, or at least valuable. And then there, because I pitched myself, it was interesting that they didn't really have a specific task for me to do, because, you know, there was no job posting, right?
Right.
So it was kind of just like, here's your desk and computer and
get to work. Architecting.
Yeah, I guess we'll figure it out. Get to work. Let's do some architecture. And then it was really there that I realized that their process for pitching and proposing work was just totally outdated. They were using Photoshop, you know, compositions, and, you know, outsourcing renders from other freelancers and stuff like that. And the work that they do is all this interactive, immersive public art exhibitions, museum shows, stuff like that. And just really.
So how was it funded? Was it all grants? And
no, actually a lot of it was private. So, you know, through collectors or museums sourcing or curating shows, or curators for big public development projects reaching out. So, I mean, Rafael's a very, you know, established artist at this time, and even more so now. So we were lucky enough to have a decent amount of inbound, at least for RFPs. And this is where the story gets interesting. We had so many RFPs that my entire first year, that's all I did, which to most people sounds terrible. They're like, you couldn't put a gun to my head and make me do that many.
So I want to understand the process. So as an artist, he had organizations coming to him saying, hey, you are this famous artist. We'd like an installation of yours in our city or our building, or whoever was pitching the idea.
Exactly.
So that's where the RFPs were coming from.
Mm-hmm. So one example would be the Planet Word Museum in Washington, D.C. It's a museum of language. And so they had a, you know, small curated competition where they hired Public Art Fund to go find, I think it was like 10 artists, give them each a couple $1,000 for an RFP, and then get each of them to come up with a concept for the outdoor permanent exhibition that would be at the entrance of the museum. So it was us against, I assume, 9 other artists. And then we all had to basically, yeah, pitch our idea for what that installation should be.
And so that's where you were coming in with that pitch, was that he and his team were putting together PDFs and foam boards.
Yeah, exactly.
And no real up-to-date technology in terms of presentation.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had done a couple of presentations previously with them. Or I shouldn't say previously, but like very early on, right? Where the process wasn't ironed out. So we were kind of just like reinventing it. And I realized, and, you know, thankfully, Rafa is so open-minded that this is where I could innovate, and that this process was just, you know, totally broken. It made no sense for someone whose work is incredibly spatial and, you know, experiential. A lot of it requires sound, video, light, interactions with people, all things that you really cannot explain in a PDF, right? And as a lesson to architects is, your work is really no different, right? Even if you're talking about a house, that house is a home to somebody, right? It's not just residential design. That's somebody's home. They want to feel what it's like to be there, not just see a pretty picture. So I think that's a mistake that many, many architects and designers across industries make, is assuming the client just wants a pretty picture. And I've heard too many people say that. I just think that's totally wrong. But in that process, you know, because I was the person on the concept design side, right? I'm working with Rafa. He's telling me the idea of the project. So in the case of Planet Word Museum, he said, hey, this is a museum of language. Let's create a tree made of metal. And the tree has hundreds of speakers hanging from it, like a weeping willow. And as somebody walks underneath the tree, there's cameras that detect the people walking, and it plays the speaker over their head. And each speaker is a different language of the world. So this tree becomes a talking repository. So the name of the piece was Speaking Willow. So that was a really beautiful piece. But as you can imagine, me describing that and like showing you a picture of a metal tree would be like, okay, I have to imagine so much from that.
You have to rely on the people who are receiving the presentation and their ability to imagine what this could be, right? You can send them pictures, you can write them words, you could probably even, you know, send them some audio, but if you have to rely on them to be able to interpret that in the way that the artist wants them to.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like the three blind men and the elephant story, right? Each one feeling a different thing and imagining a different animal. So, you know, I think that's the problem with how a lot of architects present now, is that it's a very disjointed and fragmented process where they're presenting all these different drawings and renders and text, and the client still has to imagine it all and put it together in their mind. And this person is not a technical, spatial person, right? If you ask the average person, how big is 3 feet? You're going to get a varying, you know, range of sizes from them.
Yes.
So that should tell you everything you need to know about giving them a drawing, right? They just will never really get it. So that's where I think I really got a chance to innovate there, was I said, you know, hey, instead of proposing these projects as just image renders, right? I think we should look into real-time 3D technology, like Unreal Engine, this game technology, and use that as a way to make renders faster and basically an infinite number that's always in line with our design changes. And then B, I had an obsession with VR. So I was like, let's use virtual reality and put the clients inside of a headset, you know, invite them to the studio, go fly out and show them exactly what the piece is going to feel like, sound like, interact with, you know, what the space will be like before it happens. So for a project like Speaking Willow, you know, I would go and have a camera and create a 3D model of the site from photogrammetry, taking pictures of the existing site, combining that with the modeled creations that would make in Rhino and Grasshopper, and then bringing that into something like Unreal Engine and turning that to a virtual reality experience, which I call immersive pitching. I don't know if anybody else uses that term, but I do. And we found that once we started doing those things, our win rate just skyrocketed.
I bet. Right?
The average win rate in the architecture industry is like 21%, right? And everyone's pitching off as a PDF that the client doesn't get. So that's that. And then once we started using VR, you know, huge upfront cost and expertise required, but our win rate was like over 80%. You know, it was just basically going to be a slam dunk like every time. And that's because they're there. And even if it's not the highest visual fidelity, you know, compared to a beautifully painted render, it's just, it explains what a space is going to feel like so intuitively to a person, that I think it is emblematic of trust. Trust that you can pull this off, because obviously you have a 3D model of the space, which clients don't understand from a render. They don't get that you modeled all that. And then trust that you know what you're doing. So it's like, this like magician who is wowing me with this virtual reality experience, if they can do this, you know, they can build this piece. So, you know, from the services aspect of architecture, it's all about trust, right? That's how you establish relationships with people and turn them into clients and ultimately pull off your most creative version, whatever project that you're doing, right? It's because a client has faith in you that you can do it.
That's a very interesting take on it. The trust that if they are experiencing it, like actually experiencing it through VR, because it's a real experience, it's just not a real space, that by experiencing it, they almost feel like it's already built. It's already done, right? So if you can create it in this 3D world, you certainly can create it in the real world. So the trust that you can do it is no longer a question, right? You already done it. So I've already experienced it. So now you can go build it. I could see how the win rate, as long as what you're designing is something that's appealing to them and they like it, that experience is a good one, then I can imagine that why would they not choose you over someone else? So how did it go beyond that? So you've developed this technology. He started using it. Lots of new projects start happening. What does that mean for you?
Yeah. So, you know, my whole first year, that's basically what we focused on. And then we ended up, you know, winning so many of these projects that we were able to basically hire the people that we needed to now deliver all of them. So then we ended up doubling in size to about 20 people. So it was definitely an interesting time to grow that quickly. And, you know, this is from 2016 to 2019, really, when all this stuff happened. We started hiring more people, more programmers, more designers, industrial designers. There are fabricators that we worked with. So then we had to kind of grapple with that, which was an unexpected challenge, I guess, where, you know, growing quickly is never easy.
Yeah.
It's not something that one normally thinks will be a problem. But I think that kind of became an issue because in the experiential world, you're doing projects so fast, right? Like, let's say we're working on Art Basel. That happens every year. So essentially, you have to come up with a new show or like new booth design and artworks every year that have a potential to sell, because you can't sell the same thing, you know, every year in a row. This is the art world.
Yeah.
So I think it became difficult then to work on all these projects simultaneously.
Yeah,
so in that sense, it was hard. And it kind of did make me realize that how we collaborate on building things is really sort of broken, where it's so hard to, you know, have a design and then update it and then update everybody else on a project.
Yep.
And when it comes to a bunch of small businesses, like I'm sure, you know, most of the listeners, you're working with all sorts of different specialists, right, in different fields that you now have to keep updated. So if you've won, let's say 10 projects and now you're working on them simultaneously, that's a lot of different parties you got to keep coordinated. And, you know, we were in the arts world, so they're all over the world. It could be Europe, Korea, Mexico, Canada, the US, a lot of different time zones. So juggling that became interesting. And that was where I also realized that how we collaborate on the spaces is pretty broken as well. I remember there was one project, it was the Speaking Willow one, where we're working remotely with our fabricators in New York, UAP, Urban Art Projects. And they're, you know, one of the biggest arts manufacturing companies. So they're very good engineers. But we were trying to talk about one particular branch on this tree and why it was not going to work, because there would be too many cables total within, you know, downstream. So, you know, branches, branches on them. So that was like the third layer, right? And why that had to go. And we were sending screenshots from Rhino back and forth for like 2 weeks, screen calling, and like nobody could really understand the problem. And it kind of made me realize, like, oh, damn, if we only had a way to just all look at the 3D model together and like be able to explain to the stakeholders looking at the 3D on both sides in New York and in Montreal and the client in DC, we could all just say, yes, it is this branch, that's the problem, and here's why. But it just became so difficult to do. And, you know, that made me realize as well that we're all spatial practitioners. Why can't we communicate in space? So I think, you know, those 5 years there were super interesting in terms of being able to work on so many great creative projects. I probably worked on like, I want to say 100 at least over my time there. But yeah, it kind of also made me realize there's a ton of problems in our industry. And
yes,
we're really late when it comes to digital adoption compared to other industries.
Yes.
For whatever reason, I don't know. But even like farmers are more advanced than we are, you know?
Well, that's a good point. Yes, with all their automated equipment.
Yeah, they have all sort of automated drones and sprayers and robots and like maps of their acreage of land, and like they track their cattle with like RFID chips. I'm like, wow, this is like science fiction. And architects were still sending screenshots of PDFs back and forth, you know, red lines.
So once you realize that and you realize there's this opportunity, what do you do next?
Yeah, so actually the pandemic happened, and that's what made me realize that if I can't fly to a place with a big beefy laptop and a VR headset, then A, I can't really help us win new business anymore, because we're back to sharing, you know, PDFs and just kind of like praying that a client actually reads it. And then, like I said, with this other project, collaboration became super difficult, right? Because we're not able to really like know that we're looking at the same thing with another team. So that's when I decided to jump ship and join forces with one of my friends, Ian Petrarca, one of my old college buddies. We're friends since freshman year at University of Michigan. And that's when we realized that there needs to be a better way for architects and designers to be able to communicate their vision of what's going to be built. And that's what Foveate was designed to do. So Foveate is an interactive pitching, presentation, and engagement platform for architects and designers. What does that mean? Basically, what it does is that it lets folks upload their CAD and BIM models from any 3D software and then share that on a link with the client, just like Google Slides or something like that. The client can use like a PDF or like a PowerPoint. They just press the arrow keys and they go from one position in space to another, and the camera automatically moves for them. So basically, with Foveate, we realized that architects and designers are really lacking tools, not for design, but for business. You know, like I said before, I was working all these proposals, and you know, with VR, I was thinking about it and I was like, I use the VR design tool to go win new business, but not everybody has a VR headset. So what device does everybody have? Everybody has a computer or a tablet. Why can't we just share the 3D model in a way that a non-technical person, i.e. any client or stakeholder, can open up on a link, they don't have to download an app, and then be able to use and basically receive a spatial experience in. So an architect can go design a spatial narrative with these different camera points of view called moments, and then annotate them. So they give them text descriptions with each camera point of view. So really trying to turn the work that architects and designers do anyway to pitch for a project into the presentation. Because it makes no sense to me that we do all this creative work, right? And then we just go put all of it kind of thoughtlessly into a PDF and try to use that to win business when it doesn't show off how creative people are. It doesn't really explain space, at least in an intuitive way. And then it doesn't actually communicate value, right? Like a PDF is so hard to assume value from if you're the client, right? Because it just looks the same as what everybody else is doing. And it doesn't really explain the expertise of an architect. Whereas if you're receiving a Foveate scene, you know, which is a real-time 3D version of a presentation, right? It's like, what if the architect had gone out of their way to build a foam core or 3D printed cat of your house before it's done? You'd probably be like, damn, Mark really knows what he's doing. Like, he's got all this figured out. Maybe it's not exactly what I want right now, but I can see that, you know, he's putting the time in there compared to the other four people that I'm speaking to, other four architects or builders who are just sending me basically like this super lengthy, almost legal document, right? It's just a different level of trust and like visual presentation, right?
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's ARCAT.com/Arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. How is Foveate different than let's say, a Revit walkthrough, right? Creating the model and then picking the different views that you want and then clicking the button and watching the model move around. What's the difference between that and what Foveit can do for you?
Yeah, so Foveit actually works with Revit. So you could just export your model out of Revit and drop it into Foveit. But the difference is Foveit's designed to be a presentation tool. So like, I'll give you an example. Architects, many of them use Bluebeam, right? And it's a PDF markup tool. You would never use Bluebeam to go present a final idea to a client. It just would not look professional. It'd be too distracting with all those unnecessary, you know, extra technical buttons, right? So Foveit's designed to take your Revit model and actually make it look pretty. So it has a whole post-processing, lighting and shading graphics engine, similar to that of a game engine like Unreal or Unity. So we'll add soft shadows and then lighting that makes it look more realistic. So you can present the idea in a way that's more attractive to a client instead of just like your Revit kind of technical view. And then it has all via the moment system, a way to annotate the story, right? So what is any deck really trying to do? It's trying to tell a narrative about something. And we all know that stories are the things that move people, right? So with Foveit, we thought, how can we create a narrative about space, right? Like if videos or film are narratives about time, right? What's the equivalent for space? And that's moving people through space and then giving them text annotations that describe, you know, what's happening here, the design ideas behind it, and basically letting the architect be the narrator again. You know, I think of architecture school where we all learn to present our ideas and defend them right in front of a group of people. Usually it's our peers, maybe some visiting professors. And it's really scary, right? You have to go up there and you have to say, this is my concept and this is why I think it's great. Here's how my design solution is addressing XYZ problem. And then, of course, you just get ripped apart by people. And that's so interesting to me because it's like in our profession, or in our training rather, we're taught to present a narrative about space. But then what we do as soon as we become a professional is that we just leave it all to a PDF. We're like, okay, well, let's just give them some long document with a bunch of pretty pictures and drawings that we assume the client will understand. And the discrepancy to me is that the proposals that we learn to make in school are very pretty, right? And they're geared towards other architects and designers, people who speak our language, the people who care about what font you're going to use inside of your drawing or like on your presentation. But then when we get to the real world, right? Your client, they don't even care about that. Like it could be in Comic Sans and they'd be fine with it 99% of the time, right? So clearly there's a mismatch between what architects are trained to do in terms of presentation and then what they actually do and what actually converts when it comes to clients. Because clients are just normal people, right? I like to think about it like your average client, let's say is your mom, right? She cannot read a blueprint. She has no idea how big 13 feet is or, you know, what the volume of the swimming pool is going to be. She wants to know, how are these new cabinets going to look in my kitchen? And one render is not enough for her. My mom just redid her kitchen, so I know this is the case. She was asking the builder for like 20 plus different renders, like every time there was a big design change, and they had it, right? They just like could not be bothered at a certain point. And it made me realize if they could just use their SketchUp model, right? And then share that on a link with my mom. She has an iPad. She goes look at it and be like, oh, okay, looks great. I don't have to ask you to give me a render of the back of the kitchen. I can just, you know, turn slightly to the left and it's there.
So walk me through a process. Let's say it's a new home and an architect has this new client. They're going to pitch this idea. They have the project. They've done their preliminary designs. What does that process look like from schematic all the way through to the end of wherever Foveit ends?
Yeah. So let's say it's the very beginning of a project. And for this case, let's use SketchUp as an example, because so many people use SketchUp. So we've actually built a SketchUp extension. We were part of the 0-60 challenge that SketchUp put on last year. So what they can do with that is if they download the extension from the extension warehouse, they can open up any SketchUp model they have, click basically export to Foveit. It takes your whole SketchUp scene, your whole SketchUp model, and it compresses and optimizes it. Then it turns it into a real-time ready 3D scene right on a link in Foveit.
So it just automatically pulls it into Foveit ready to go.
Automatically. And then all the SketchUp scenes, the different camera points of view in your SketchUp project, those get converted into Foveit moments. So each SketchUp scene typically has a title and a description, and those will get translated over. So it automatically becomes a basically instantly ready real-time 3D presentation that they can send to a client, and they can invite team members to it. So for example, you know, let's say your junior designer is the one working in SketchUp. Once they upload to Foveate SketchUp model, they can just invite the project manager or the director, principal, what have you, and basically show them, hey, here's the link to the Foveate scene. I think we're ready to send this to a client. And maybe the PM says, oh, can you add some renders and PDF drawings to it? It's easy for now the junior designer to go back to SketchUp, export those out, drag and drop in their JPEGs and PDFs, put them to Foveate, and then using Moments, attach them to different points of view in space. So the client can see, oh, here's where this high quality render was taken from in this model. Here's where this drawing, this point of view of the drawing is in this model. So they can kind of locate, here's the plan view, and the camera, you know, will move up in Foveate and look straight down. And here's plan view in the model. So a client doesn't have to piece together things in their mind. All of a sudden, there is one holistic way that they can understand all these different assets types around. So the 3D model becomes the spatial awareness that the client is getting and is able to attach these other pieces of media, renders, photos, drawings too, and kind of understand it all together.
So you create your own scene and your own presentation, basically, because that's what it is. So you choose the views that the client's going to see, the information at each moment they can receive. Can they also have control over the model as well if they wanted to sort of explore it on their own? Is it possible to do that as well?
Yeah, so that's something that people have been asking us. Right now, how we have it is that the architect or designer, they create different camera points of view, and the client or the receiver, they can move the camera around, but they can't necessarily just go anywhere. And what we've heard from our users is that they don't want the client to be able to explore too much on their own, because there might be something in the model that's not quite done,
right,
and they don't want to hear from them that this is a problem. Which is fair. So that's why.
Yeah. And that would be unexpected from a client's point of view. It's like, why is the back of this model not finished?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so we don't want a client to be able to go run around and view parts that they're not supposed to.
Gives you more control as the designer.
Exactly. So that's why there's no like first person character, you know, running around the scene. It's kind of like the Enscape WebGL exporters like that. We're very curated. The Moment system, they are the slides of an interactive presentation, right? So they're the curated points of view that tell the story, almost like a film where, you know, as a cinematographer or something or director, you want to curate these points of view in time. And that's what the different scenes of the film are, the different cuts. That's what we're trying to do with Moments, is give architects that narrative power. And I have this intuition that I suspect every architect would also make a great filmmaker and probably secretly wants to be. And this is kind of how I think they can do it. At least about, you know, space.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I sort of, as you're discussing it, and you sort of described it in the very beginning, it is very much like taking the way PowerPoint is used and was used and taking it to the next level, right? Saying, okay, if it's just going to be one slide after another with pictures, now you can take those slides, make those slides moments and specific moments of this spatial experience, and every time they click the button to the next slide, they're actually moving through the space, seeing the model move as it goes to the next moment and lands in the next slide or moment that Foveate has for you. And then the information that you would typically present in a PDF is there as well. So you have the information that you need to present at that moment. And then when they're ready to go to the next slide, you go to the next slide. And so this can be presented, I'm assuming, live, right? So you can be speaking to them as you're going through this presentation, or if it's designed this way, they can be presented much like if you just send somebody a PDF deck or a PowerPoint deck that they can go through it on their own as well, right?
Exactly. So with Foveate, there's two ways you can present. There's present mode, where if you send a link to somebody in the editor of Foveate, you can click present and then it gathers everyone's cameras to your position. So there's no like screen sharing lag. They're actually in the 3D scene with you, just looking from your point of view. So that way you can guarantee that you're in control of them viewing it. And this is really kind of solving that story that I was telling you about. It's about Speaking Willow, trying to talk about that one branch where I was like, if only I could know that everybody's looking at the same point of view that I'm looking at. And as soon as I look left, they're looking left. There's no choppiness in the screen sharing. That's really what I wanted. So that's option A. And option B is just sharing a link to a Foveate scene with somebody. and that is the asynchronous mode. So that's like sending somebody a Google slide or a PowerPoint deck and them going through it on their own. And that's really useful when people are in different time zones or different schedules. You know, someone needs to go pick up their kids, so they can't get on a call right now, but it's ready for them to view. They can just, you know, view it at home whenever they need to. So it is kind of wild to me that there isn't something like that for architecture. You know, we really thought that somebody would do it during COVID and nobody did it. So that's another reason why we decided to start Fofeed. It's just the technology has not progressed at all for architects. And in my estimation, I asked myself, in 5, 10, 20 years, are we still going to be sending PDFs as the main way to win business, as the way to build a building? Will our future cities, you know, airports, stadiums, casinos, resorts, homes, malls, will they all be designed just with PDFs? And I'm not so sure. You know, technology is moving pretty fast. Just because we as an industry are kind of slow to adopt doesn't mean that technology is going to stop. So I think it's inevitable that something like Fofeed will become the dominant way that we communicate space. I think it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. What do you see the future look like in terms of both Fofeed and architecture, let's say in the next 5 years, which I used to say 10 years, but 10 years is an eternity today. So what's your take on Fofeed in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, so for us, we, and this kind of makes sense with my background and Ian's background, my co-founder as well, is we're really focusing on experiential these days as kind of our beachhead customer group. And that's people, for folks who are not familiar, in kind of like the event space. So think corporate meetings, trade shows, conferences, brand activations, concerts, festivals, cruise ships, theme parks, museums, basically parts of architecture that A, require a lot of like immersive media and like are more entertaining. And then B, are about gathering. They're about fostering real life human connection. And the reason why we're focused on that is because Fofeed has support for all sorts of different media. You can have video walls, like LEDs or projectors inside of Fofeed. You can put audio in, whether that's music or sound effects. So we're finding that, also we worked in the industry, that those are the people who are immediately interested in Fofeed, right? You go to a big corporate event, like let's say a Javits Center trade show, right? So many of these booths have TVs, they have flashing things, they have moving parts, and they're events that happen very frequently and are very difficult to design and kind of collaborate on. So that's kind of where we're looking at immediately just because of our business. And we also are just thinking about the post-AI and post-social media landscape, right? I think, unfortunately, AI has been posited to the world as something to replace humans. Like, there are so many other things AI could be used for, but that's the narrative, right? It's like, stop hiring real humans, just use an AI, and AI will be able to do everything for you in the near future, right? And we're just thinking about that, plus the idea of social media just becoming more and more and more sort of dominant, where among young people, especially like, you know, TikTok and Instagram, are these huge spheres that people have been participating in and kind of got lost in during COVID and now are wanting to kind of get out of, right? They're seeking real life experiences, but there's not that much out there for them. So that's another reason why we're really into experiential is we are predicting in a very short period of time, there will be this huge growth and kind of yearning to convene in real life spaces. And then the demand for those spaces and what they are will increase. So for example, Gen Z, when they're surveyed, they have a much lower tolerance, I guess higher, much higher tolerance for cleanliness than boomers or older age people, meaning they want their spaces to be cleaner. But this is mainly in the context of like theme parks and stadiums and stuff like that, where they're just asking for different things and they want to meet not just on TikTok and online. So many of them were a bit socially stunted during COVID. And I think, you know, we all were. And now we're seeing like concerts and real life events becoming more and more attractive. And the prices that people will pay are becoming even higher. And I think as AI becomes more commonplace, right, the typical traditional building archetypes, residential, commercial, condos, stuff like that, they just get swallowed by AI. There's no reason why an AI, let's say in 3 to 5 years, won't be able to design literally every single variation of a home that someone can think of, right? Like the classic American house, right? Colonial style house timber framing, it's very simple. Like there's going to be a point, I think, in the next couple of years where that is just going to be totally be able to be designed by an AI, like every variation for every plot, and architects won't really need to do that. So that's another reason where I'm like, ooh, architects, I think, who get into these other formats that I just described, they're A, like more creative, so like more in tune with what architects do, in my opinion. And then B, they're receiving a lot of investment. So like Disney is putting $60 billion into new theme parks, resorts, cruise ships, experiences, theater shows, what have you. The Olympics is coming to LA in 2028. Like the Sphere in Vegas is the most expensive building like ever. And they're doing another one in Abu Dhabi. So I'm drinking my own Kool-Aid here, but I'm seeing these projects pop up and I'm like, I don't see how they're not going to be successful, in the sense that people are willing to pay more money to go to see something cool, to go see something with other people that's out of their everyday experience, right? Like now you walk out your door, there's so many of the same experience, you know, like all restaurants and cafes are basically identical. There's very little variation in what one can go do to have an entertaining or interesting time when it comes to space and experiences. So I think these other places of entertainment are just going to become kind of those spots where people will want to meet up. They're going to want to spend their time and money there. Because to me, the home is going to be A, more commodified by AI, and then B, most of the time when people are home, they're just spending it on their screens, on watching Netflix, on TikTok, you know, playing video games, watching movies. So to get them out of the house is going to be, it's going to have to be a pretty cool, pretty interesting experience.
Yeah. The human to human connection is going to become paramount, and the experiences that we have with one another will become the thing that we do, right? Because everything else will be able to be done by other technologies, but the human to human connection and the experiences we have with one another can't be replicated.
No.
And so that's a very interesting take. Yeah.
And architects, that's what we're trained to do. Like, if forget about the profession for a second, just think back to school when we were all training. What we were trained to do was to create spaces for people, right? We'd be like, oh,
right,
this is a hallway, right? It's a compressive space. It's going to channel people to this main room. This is a ballroom where people will actually convene. It's a place of spectacle where you go to be seen by others or like see a performance. There's two different kinds of people. There's observers and performers, right? So I think when you actually get down to the meat of like why we all became architects, it was to shape space and ultimately to use that to shape people and shape relationships around people. And that's what we're all so good at, and that's our expertise, but we have such a devil of a time communicating that to other people. So I think experiential is one of those ways where it's kind of built into the conversation of,
yes,
oh, you're not just putting up trusting, you're not just building walls, you're actually creating something that people want to come to. And that's why I think it's so interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So we need to wrap up here. So I want to ask your final question here. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One of them that comes to mind is they need to be able to communicate their value. So I think a lot of architects, they think that if they put their work on like Design Boom or DZine, like they're going to start getting all this work, right? But really, I think what they need to do is speak to a regular person. And one way they can do that, I think, is to get on social media. And this is like kind of a 180 from what I just said. But I think it is good for them to do that. And it's free. It's easy to do. There's almost no competition. I remember reading a report that actually Jen Kastensen sent me.
Yep.
And it was about how builders who got onto social media had like a 6,000% increase in leads. And I was just shocked by the figure, but it kind of makes sense, right? What are you doing when you're posting on social media, at least in the way that you're showing process of you building or designing or something like that, is you're communicating value, right? So you're showing exactly what you do on day to day. You're basically warming somebody up to contact you or refer you to somebody else who could use your services, right? And then you're also using the most powerful piece of technology that exists right now, the algorithm, to go find the right clients for you. So if you're a business that specializes in doing pop-ups for makeup brands, right, that's the kind of architecture you do, then you put that on social media, the algorithm is going to try and go find people who would be interested in that thing. So I think that's one thing that architects and designers can do in the short term. That'll be massively helpful. Not just posting pretty pictures of projects on Instagram, but actually like showing process and then talking
and
about
being more intentional.
Being more intentional and talking about who they are. Like, documentation is very broken in our industry in the sense where it's not thought about as a process at all. The documentation is marketing. And they don't, like I said before, they don't want to just see a pretty picture. People want to understand what an architect does. And it's so interesting if you actually think about it. It's just we are really bad at communicating it to other people. So I think that is one thing that they can do right now to change their business. And I'm not sure they'll be able to do it in a couple of years and have it be nearly as effective. So I think that's one thing they can do. And another thing I think they can do is develop a style. And the reason I say that is, you know, when we were in these competitions, right? If you have a certain style of work, even if it's a blind competition, everybody knows that's you. So for example, say you're doing a Guggenheim competition and Zaha Hadid is in it. You know which project is by Zaha Hadid. You don't even have to see their name, right? It's just so clear. And that style is helpful because it communicates to the client, right? Like what you're about, what you value. And if they value those same things, they come to you. So if they value tech and kind of like this flowing, organic shape that's like very modern and futuristic, then you go for Zaha. It just makes sense. And style and architecture is basically our industry's version of branding. So that's the way that I think about it, is like, what is the brand of your small firm or studio, right? Are you more of a design studio and you want to be like really posh and just focus on super high-end fixtures, right? And if you brand yourself as that, then when you're in a competition versus somebody else, right, all of a sudden there's more of a reason to pick you than that other person. So I would say, yeah, branding, thinking about branding yourself strategically is important. And that will help small businesses and studios, A, I think, yeah, win more projects. And then B, figure out who to market to and like who is their audience. Like with Foveat, I said, it's like we're focusing on experiential. And that's a strategic decision because the market is huge. There's so many different types of architecture firms and work. We can't go after all of them, right? So let's pick people who we think are our ideal customer that we want to work with, that we'd be happy doing projects with and helping. So I would say those two kind of go hand in hand for small architects developing a brand / style that's identifiable, that is in tune with your values, and then B, using different platforms to communicate that. And it doesn't have to be TikTok. You know, it could be Instagram, Facebook, Pinterest, local media. So I think it just, that depends on what kind of brand you have, how you want to communicate it. But I would say those two, to me, are the most important things that are very low cost, pretty easy to implement, and can have decently quick turnarounds and really just help you focus your business. I think half the battle, right, is just being able to say no to things and knowing that's not going to be a good choice. Like for architects, you guys do not do every single RFP that comes across your desk, right? Create like a scoring system of, is this worth it in terms of clout? Like, is this going to be something I want to share? Is the money good enough? Is this going to be a huge pain in the ass to deal with and like work with these people or the other people on this project? You know, create a scoring system that will help you make decisions. So I think, you know, having that combination, well, really just having the branding will help you kind of decide with that scoring system if this project or client is going to be worth it for you. And there's so many times when, you know, you should say no. I would say that's another thing. And just being aware of that and being able to position yourself in a way that you can basically make your leads and inbound be more in line with what you want to do.
His name is Kite Kim, and the company is Foveat, and the website is foveat.com. So it's foveate.com. Go check it out. It's a pretty impressive piece of technology that they put together. Kite, we never got to the origin story of the company, which I want to talk about someday, because this was a fascinating conversation. I did not want to derail it by bringing that up. So maybe we'll do that another day. I appreciate you for sharing your knowledge and your story today and for coming by at Entree Architect Podcast.
Oh yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Mark. Truly a pleasure.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season 1, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.